Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, we honor a beloved trailblazer who became the first woman in Wisconsin to serve as Lieutenant Governor, Margaret Farrow. Plus, a judge releases nearly 800 pages of documents related to Michael Gableman's election investigation. And it's a wrap. The state Senate adjourned after passing 80 bills, marking an end to a two-year floor period. We highlight what bills now head to the governor's desk. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 11th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're going to start off the show honoring Margaret Farrow, who passed away this week and was the first lieutenant governor in Wisconsin. Now, she was first elected to the state assembly in 1986 and then was the board chair of, actually, Wisconsin I from 2021. She also served on the UW Board of Regents. And, you know, once people in the political world got word of her passing, there was, numerous people talking and praising her. We heard from Tommy Thompson, who called her a grand lady of politics in the Republican Party and called her the Margaret Thatcher of Wisconsin. We also heard from her son, Paul Farrow, who is the GOP chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, calling his mother a trailblazer, not only because of her significant positions as a woman and what she was very much a man's world at the time, but because the way she stood up for all people in our community and our state to represent the best interests for decades. Now, she was a public servant that stretched over five decades, and she was one of the key advocates to make Wisconsin I what it is today. She served in this network for over 20 years as a volunteer board member, and we just kind of want to take a little snippet of when she was at a presentation to kind of the ribbon cutting to opening Wisconsin I, which, of course, the core principles was to increase transparency for people to get this inside look of state government. So let's take a listen from Margaret.
4 years ago when I left this building, I didn't think I'd ever be at a press conference again in the Rotunda. I am so thrilled that it is Wisconsin I and that we are about to open up this wonderful building and its operations to the people of the state of Wisconsin. And I hope we just grow. As Senator Richter said, the Wisconsin idea has always been there, and maybe the generations who will be watching it now will, through Wisconsin I, continue to make us a leader across the country.
So, JR, we really have her to thank for us being able to sit here today.
Margaret, I covered the tail end of her being in the legislature and her stint as a first female lieutenant governor. Margaret Farrow was somebody who was partisan and principled without being, letting her antics overshadow her arguments. She could throw an elbow. She was by no means a squish politically in terms of her views, but she always wasn't unpleasant about it. It's a time when it wasn't about your social media account or what kind of attention you got with what you said. It was the substance of what you said. I'm not saying she was a saint politically. Like I said, I've watched a couple of tough arguments with her, but she was definitely just a time from when there's still some class in politics. I guess I'd put it that way.
Yeah, like a different era of politics. Yes. Where I think I would agree completely with the whole social media aspect, where everyone's picking, political fights and whatnot. And, why don't you do that in person? Face someone and have those arguments, right? And get stuff done.
Yes.
Now, the one of the biggest stories this week, and we talked about it almost every single week, was Gableman got his contract extended to continue his election investigation. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss signed a new extension that will now allow him to continue his work until April. Now, Gableman will not receive any additional funding per the contract, but he can use the remaining taxpayer funds to fight ongoing lawsuits. Now, Republicans approved a $676,000 taxpayer budget for his review, and we heard Gableman say when he testified to lawmakers on March 5th, he has about $300,000 remaining. But American Oversight, who sued to release records related to his investigation that we'll get to, they had a victory in court, and they said, sifting through hundreds of pages of documents, that Gableman has actually spent $519,000. So the real question here is, we now know he has until the end of April, but will he have enough money? left in reserves to fight these lawsuits. And it's there's this little gray area in the contract that says that, well, he can maybe add to his interim report. He can still keep doing things, but it remains to be seen.
And he can get outside counsel, and right. there's no cap on that outside counsel. So part of what happened with the budget was the original vision for this thing, the spreadsheet, had about $300,000 for this sort of forensic audit, however you want to define that, with ballots. Gabelin's allowed to move money around from the original allocation. So, like, for example, I looked at him back in January. He already spent his whole office supply budget by then. So you can just take whatever line it was before, move it. It's one big pot of money. He's authorized to do that. The big thing, though, is the uncapped legal fees, because we are going into a scenario where this could go on for a while. So he can exhaust the state taxpayer dollars on what he's doing, but also keep fighting stuff in court. He can also provide legal counsel to the Assembly, Robin Voss, I believe, also without caps on those legal fees. So I'm not quite sure what that means, because it's not really well defined in the product, but it looks like there could be more cost than the $676,000 put aside for the original budget for this thing.
And the big question is, will these lawsuits be resolved by the end of April?
Yeah.
We don't know. It's over the subpoenas that he's issued to multiple election officials, municipal clerks, and IT departments, too, of the five largest cities, too, just trying to, you know, get numerous records. Oh. And they've been fighting those for months now, because they do not want to sit down with Gabelman for these private interviews, which he claims would, you know, really wrap up his investigation.
And Senator Mark Spreitzer posted like 86 different subpoenas that he got from Gabelman's office. Remember, Gabelman went before the committee and said, it was asked by Spreitzer, can you give us the subpoenas? So yeah, I'll give them to you. Turn them over, but looks like a lot never went out because they were for out-of-state entities. We know, for example, we tried to subpoena these two election equipment companies in Nebraska. They're like, take a hike. We're not going to do anything with this. But he also tried to subpoena employees with the Hyatt Regency in Green Bay. There was some connection with the central count location for Green Bay with the hotel. A guy who works for Airbnb, who apparently was, at the time of the 2020 election, was working as a kind of a partner with the CTCL, the group that funded all these private grants to state or the cities to pay for election costs. So there's this wide net of people who aren't obvious connections to, like, administering elections. So why were they included? What was he after? We don't know, and don't know if they were actually served, because an email from an aide of his to Mark Spreitzer says, here are the subpoenas. By the way, email misspelled Robin Voss's name twice as Voss, V-O-S-S. Here are the subpoenas. The ones out of state didn't go out, but here's everything anyway. So what else is out there? Because Gabelman also said he had about 100 subpoenas. Now, 86 is about 100, but I don't know if there's more, because these were from the batches in October and December. We know there were more in this year.
Yeah.
So where else is he going with this thing? It's not going to wrap up. If it gets done by April, I guess people would be surprised to talk to.
I would be surprised as well. Now, on the same day that we learned of a new contract extension, President Trump got involved and sent out a statement praising Gabelman for his work, which we're talking about his interim report that he released and testified to lawmakers about, claiming, you know, many inaccuracies in the election, gave recommendations. So Trump says, you know, he feels confident that Speaker Robin Voss will exercise his, quote, moral duty to follow up on Gabelman's findings. And in addition to announcing they will stay in session to take action on getting rid of Eric and the WEC, the state's elections commission. Now, the hidden message in here, JR, is that you and I both know that lawmakers have said they are not coming back. They wrapped up a marathon session over the past 2 weeks. They got done with all of their election bills. They don't have any plans to address Eric at all. Eliminating WEC, we know Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been vocally against. So once again, we're hearing, you know, we're seeing this President Trump trying to say, you know, praise all the work that Gabelman's doing and putting Robin Voss in a tough spot.
Oh, it proves it's never going to be enough. No matter what you do, unless you overturn the election, which we know can happen from multiple attorneys, other than Gabelman's report arguing that there is an option there. He's one of the few people I've seen try to argue that there is an option. It's never going to be enough. And if you read the statement, maybe Trump's trying to be aspirational, that he hopes they're going to stay in session. They've adjourned pursuant to SJR1, the joint resolution creating the session. They are done. Mm-hmm. They come back in special session, but as you pointed out, they don't want to get rid of WEC. Eric is the multi-state list of voters. It's a cooperative, basically, so you can double check, did you vote both in Iowa and Wisconsin in the election? It has become some kind of boogeyman.
Right.
To those on the right, Gabelman tried to go after Eric during his presentation to the committee, suggesting that it was, I don't know, funded by George Soros and all these kind of things about it. But it's been used to try and find people who shouldn't vote and that they voted, and they go after them after that. So there's that weird thing. But Trump is going to keep putting pressure on these guys to do what he wants them to do. And it's just, I don't think it's ever going to end. And it's, when you talk to Republicans privately, they are exasperated that this continues to go on and there's no end in sight. Well, by the way, there's an election in November. Will it all be wrapped up by then? Because I'd bet you a drink that they're not going to overturn the results before November, right?
Right.
So what happens if they've come to that conclusion in October and they're not going to overturn the results? Like, it's done. Then what happens?
Right.
What's Trump do then?
Exactly. And also, big story this week is that Dane County judge released over 700, well, to be exact, because I've read most of them. The judge released 761 pages of records related to Gabelman's investigation. Now, this is what I talked about earlier in the show. It granted the liberal watchdog group American Oversight a victory because they have filed a couple lawsuits seeking a lot of information about Gabelman's probe. And what we found through these records, at least what I've seen, is that Gabelman was still hiring staff, inquiring about furnishing his office, figuring out the scope of his investigation just weeks before his original deadline was set by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss to finish up his work. So it kind of just goes to show that he was still not doing much investigating during the months of October and November, and he was still trying to figure out what he really wants to look into, what the scope statement should look like, all those types of things. And what was interesting that we heard from the judge is that he released these records because he basically didn't think there was much of an investigation going on. We're going to take a listen from him as well. And he just kind of called the overall probe underwhelming. And that was his reasoning why these records should not be kept from the public.
And based on my knowledge, training, and experience, there's nothing here. By lifting the seal on these documents, I believe that it's for every man now to determine whether I've erred, to examine these documents. And I believe that when done so, we'll come to the conclusion that this has been much to do about nothing, that these documents do not support the argument that there has been an investigation, much less the conclusions that have been made. There is no reason to grant a stay, and therefore the court's decision ordering their immediate release now stands.
The same week, another judge also is kind of demanding Robin Voss to turn over deleted emails and other records related to Gabelman's investigation. So we're about to find out a little bit more, possibly, about what's been going on for months and how this taxpayer money has been being spent.
And this is the danger for Robin Voss. The longer this goes on, the more you're looking for stuff. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong, right? There's going to be anything in the emails that's going to be a problem. But what if there's something that looks bad, right? What if there's something, an offhand remark that can be taken and misinterpreted? You have opened the door to like this perpetual search for your records and emails and phone calls and everything else that could turn up who knows what. And that is, again, the whole issue with this. It's not going to end for a while, and there's going to be fodder for American Oversight keep suing over stuff or looking for stuff for weeks and not months.
And, you know, Gabelman's investigation, too, you know, all along is that, you know, they want to be taken seriously, that, you know, they're really looking into these election concerns. But when you're looking through these documents and you're discovering things, you know, I talked to a lot of political science experts that say it really just kind of shows what a mess it's been from the start.
And now Gabelman's what, on Tucker Carlson and Steve
Bannon? I was just going to say he went on a bunch of TV appearances, but really there's nothing new that he has uncovered that we have not reported about in the past. We've known about the issues about the grants, the private grants, the Zuckerbucks, as Republicans call them, being funded. We know about the concerns in nursing homes, but there's no big, really big new revelations, I guess you can say, that we've seen so far. And where is this? What's the final end point?
Part of Gabelman's report was, what, 30 nursing homes in Milwaukee County had 100% turnout. The Milwaukee City election executive director said here are the 32 or 33 nursing homes in the city of Milwaukee. Turnout was actually not 100%. Mm-hmm. I went through and here are numbers. I think it was 70-some percent, 79. Now, what she told me was that, looking at her spreadsheet, she thinks Gabelman doesn't understand how this thing works, which is, unfortunately, people in nursing homes pass away and move. So if you look at the people who registered as of election day and people registered as of today, you might get a different number, right, because they've either moved or passed away. You have to look at who was registered on election day in that nursing home to figure out what the actual turnout was. When you look at who was actively registered on that day, you get a much lower number. Now, he's looking at 30 in the county. She's looking at 32 or 33 in the city, so there may be some disparity there. But that said, it casts some doubt on, well, what work did you do? What numbers are you comparing for nursing homes if you're going to make this big claim about, like, there's 100% turnout at these nursing homes?
Yeah, and speaking of nursing homes, last update on our election wrap, I guess you could say, is that the Racine County Sheriff that we've talked about on a few times, who has alleged voter fraud in these nursing homes, has been denied by some DAs, the Racine County DA, to look to criminally charge members of the State Elections Commission. Then the next step is that the sheriff then went to, you know, the Milwaukee County DA saying, hey, take a look at this, because the Racine district attorney couldn't charge them because they didn't live, the members didn't live in that area. So Milwaukee DA this week rejected criminally charging members of the State Elections Commission.
Yeah, and the Racine County DA got into, like, she said there was something off here, but I can't, I've got jurisdiction issues.
Right.
Milwaukee County says, he's basically picked apart the argument bit by bit, like this, no. For example, special voting deputies do not have a role in determining if a voter should be disqualified from voting, right? They don't go in and say, okay, I don't think you're competent to vote. That is not their role, but that's been a big hang-up for some, saying, well, they should have been there to judge these folks. Well, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of picked apart the Racine County Sheriff's arguments about some of the stuff. Now, we have three more DAs we're waiting to hear from about what they're going to do, but it's not looking good. There being charges filed against elections commissioners from all this.
And then we've mentioned a few times that lawmakers wrapped up ending their two-year legislative session. And this week, no big surprise here, but Governor Evers also called during his State of the State address for a special session to vote on his surplus plan. Senate and Assembly quickly gaveled in and out within minutes. Governor Evers' plan would have given every Wisconsinite a $150 check, made investments in child care, and would have spent $750 million towards K-12 education and higher ed. The governor, of course, was pretty upset that they gaveled in and out without taking any votes. In a quote, he said, Republicans are selfishly playing politics by sitting on a projected $3.8 billion surplus until next year, while the people of this state watch prices, everyday items go up, especially gas. We all know it, right? It is past $4 a gallon in many states of Wisconsin. So their big argument was, hey, now is the time to do this. Republicans long have said it's an election year gimmick, even though they supported a similar kind of, you know, child tax cut when Governor Walker was in office in 2018.
Evers opposed that one in 2018.
Evers opposed,
too.
So it's purely, you know, it's politics. We get it, but we all know all along, top Republicans have said they want to use the money on tax cuts next year.
Yes.
So then we can get to wrapping up and highlighting more than 80 bills, I want to say, the state Senate passed this week, JR.
Yep.
We're going to highlight a few education bills that the state Senate took final action on, breaking up Milwaukee public schools that would break them up into 4 to 8 smaller districts. We have AB 970 that would eliminate income limits for people who apply to the school voucher programs. Another bill would overhaul the state's reading readiness program that would require basically holding back third graders if they score below a certain level on their reading test that they take. And another one would create a parental bill of rights aimed at giving parents more say over what happens in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So let's take a listen to, I think, one of the interesting bills here is breaking up MPS. It's an idea, I think it was 2017, was first introduced by Leah Vukmir. It's nothing new. I don't quote me on the date. But we actually had Republican Senator Dale Cuenga from Brookfield joining Democrats in opposition on the floor on this. So let's take a listen from some of the floor debate.
Stop pretending like you want to do something, but you're doing what creates divide in our community. You're doing something, but you're not including the very people that are in the community. You wouldn't do it for your district. You would not have it. Because in the end, the issue at hand is our children are failing and you're just making the pipeline the prison, and then you do the legislation to make it possible for more of that to happen, and then you don't fund the programs that need to happen inside the prison. This bill is a flat out no. Don't ever give me nothing. That's going to depend on the East Wing to do it for the city.
And I worked at Milwaukee Public Schools because I was an auditor, and Milwaukee Public Schools was one of my clients. And what I saw there drove me further into conservatism. It was jaw-dropping. They are focused on their pensions and their careers, and they are not focused on the kids. That is a fact. And the fact also that I see is that if we are going to replicate Milwaukee Public Schools in little MPSs, you're going to take the same employees who are going to make the same hiring decisions, and instead of having one CFO, you're going to have eight. Instead of having one internal audit department, you're going to have eight. Instead of having one equity inclusion department, you're going to have eight. And the decisions made will be decisions that serve the adults, not the students, as the parent company or the parent organization has done for decades.
The other theme that we saw on the Senate floor on Tuesday was crime and COVID-19 related bills. Just want to touch on a few of those. When it comes to crime, preventing law enforcement agencies from banning no-knock warrants, that became an issue after Milwaukee police banned it themselves from not having no-knock warrants. So they want to not allow police departments to make their own decisions when it comes to that. Another one that we've talked many times on the show before would authorize borrowing to build a new youth prison in Milwaukee County. That might be one of the very few that, yes, Governor Evers might sign out of all these bills that we're highlighting right now. COVID-19 banned state and local governments from discriminating against someone based on their COVID-19 vaccine status. Another bill would prohibit governments from declaring some businesses as non-essential. And the last COVID-19 related bill would allow students to opt out of mask mandates at school as long as they get their parents' permission. So, JR, out of all of these, like I said, I think maybe a few the governor would sign, definitely the Lincoln Hills one, but all the rest of the ones that we have highlighted are likely doomed for the governor's veto.
Evers set 48 vetoes, complete vetoes of bills right now, the record since 1931. When Reference Bureau began tracking the data is 72. I am fairly confident the bills just on the Senate agenda from Tuesday will put him over the top. When he's all said and done, it's just a matter of how much he exceeds the record of Gaylord Nelson when he had the Democratic governor at the time had a GOP legislature. How that 61-62 session was the record 72 of Gaylord Nelson. So I just want to know how far he exceeds that number when it's all said and done.
Right, and what I also found interesting this legislative session that bills got into the 1,000s.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare that they get all the way up there. You see the couple 900 numbers, but I was like, wow.
Well, they got up there and they passed out of the House.
Yes.
That's what was different, too. Like,
right.
You see a lot of like bills that are like, oh, I got to get this done before I go home for the session. Yeah. Get introduced. But that was first time I've seen bills in the thousands passing both houses.
Yeah, definitely. Big news this week, too, is another redistricting follow-up, I guess you'd say. GOP lawmakers on the state and congressional level are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to replace Governor Tony Evers' redistricting plan by the maps, with his map. I'm misquoting myself. GOP lawmakers are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to replace Governor Tony Evers' redistricting plan with their map drawn by Republicans. So they're seeking to block Evers' maps that were endorsed last week by the state Supreme Court. Of course, Republicans are fighting hard against this. They want their maps in place instead. In a quote from Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue, our objection to Evers' maps is not a question of partisan outcome, but rather a question of law. The governor, by his own legal argument, targeted minority voters to draw districts on the basis of race. So at issue here, JR, is Evers' maps that were approved by the state Supreme Court draw 7 majority black districts in Milwaukee, and under current law, there are only 6. That's been kind of a key focal point.
We talked last week, there's a 3-part test you have to meet whenever you take race into account drawing a district. The filing from state lawmakers says they didn't meet that standard. Actually, they really ripped the state Supreme Court ruling that it was inadequate, its analysis of that standard, insufficient. Therefore, the court should overturn that map, put theirs in place in the meantime, which would be very good for them, obviously. The congressional delegation, the Republican members of that, they have a different argument. That is a 2-pronged argument. One, that there was a bait and switch, essentially, from the state Supreme Court. In November, the court in a 4-3 ruling said, we're going to take a least change approach to these maps. And the impression was, the argument goes, there were a number of criteria that would be used. In the end, the court, at the behest of Brian Hagedorn, relied solely on core retention. They say that's not fair, bait and switch. Then they also make an argument about one person, one vote. You have to have your districts be pretty much equal, their argument goes, and there's a deviation of two people. So plus or minus two, that to them is too much, allowed, so they're going to challenge it on that. Justice Barrett has set a deadline of today for responses to the state Republican lawmakers' request, on Monday for the federal lawmaker, Republican lawmakers' request, and in the background, you have the state Supreme Court, which has been asked to put its ruling on hold while the Republicans appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court took arguments by earlier this week, and we're waiting at any minute for the court to say yay or nay. Side note, one of the lawyers for Republicans in a filing with the U.S. Supreme Court said, we don't think we're going to win the state Supreme Court, so that's even more reason for you guys to step in. The U.S. Supreme Court, they do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee they'll take the case. There were two separate maps drawn by state Supreme Courts in Pennsylvania, I believe, and another in North Carolina. They declined to take those cases, but they're different cases. They don't deal with race the way this one does. I would never predict the U.S. Supreme Court will do, but we'll probably know within a couple of weeks. And oh, by the way, the filing window to start circulating nomination papers begins April 15th. There's both a deadline, a time crunch going on right now for this to happen.
And that kind of leads into my next point, is that there's a little bit of a shakeup in the state Senate, mm-hmm. Because Senator Dale Cahuenga, technically by the maps that the state Supreme Court kind of gave the thumbs up to, would push Cahuenga out of his district. And he kind of made a point of this on the floor, saying, hey, this is kind of unfair. We don't really, you know, we'll get a little bit later in the show about who might run for a seat or what might happen. But let's just take a listen from Cahuenga's argument, and then we're also going to hear from Governor Evers kind of saying, well, there wasn't really any politics involved in this at all.
In a very, very personal move, which happened last week, is I have not only been gerrymandered in the district, but I have been gerrymandered and moved outside the 5th Senate District. A belt and suspenders approach to make sure that I am not part of this chamber. Voters will not get to decide since there's no primary in the district I've been moved to.
The requirements as put forth by the Supreme Court limited our options significantly. And so the fact of the matter is it passed 4-3 in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and there was not politics involved. We were just trying to make sure that votes count in this state.
Now, JR, let's move on to stock picks. Another round of retirements that we're talking about on this show, and this time it is Ringland and Petrowski in the state Senate.
So those two were at six departures from the state Senate now, either retirements or seeking another office. It's Roger Roth from Appleton running for lieutenant governor. The other five are retiring. Quick note, Petrowski and Ringhan are both kind of nice people. They're lawmakers who aren't bomb throwers on the floor. They're
definitely
nice to work with, mm-hmm. Had that reputation. You're losing two of those folks from the chamber. Now, Mark Spreitzer of Beloit, Ariane's going to run for Ringhan's seat. Pat Schneider, a member of the assembly from Schofield, he's going to run, I'm pretty sure, for Petrowski. He told me strongly considering it. I talked to him on Thursday.
Careful with their words, yeah.
That usually means I'm going to run. It's a matter of me announcing. I'm not going to step on Jerry's toes. That would make 14 departures from the assembly. We might have a 15th from Samantha Kirkman running for Kenosha County Executive. I expect there to be more before it's all said and done. We are at now, even with the churn from 2020 and 2018 for either retiring or another office, I think we're going to eclipse that. And there's a generational change going on right in the Capitol. Think about it.
Definitely.
Ringhan and Bewley are both Senate leadership for Democrats. They both cited age and retiring. There's going to be a much younger leadership team in the Senate, much like in the Assembly.
Yeah.
It's a much younger leadership team for Democrats. It's going to be real, real interesting to watch how that plays out.
And mixed this week, you have TV spending and the governor's race with RGA making a big commitment to spend over $6 million after Labor Day.
Yeah, so what's interesting is they're not going to spend it, though, until after Labor Day. Now, when I talk to people, they're like, okay, but who's going to hit Evers net between now and Labor Day, right? Because Evers got to 50% in the Marquette poll last week. He is somewhat unknown, soft sometimes in the perception of him because he's not like a polarizing figure like Walker was. So you could either maybe tear him down a bit between now and Labor Day, or you could build him up, depending on what your perspective is, right? So I ask people, like, well, is this good to be coming in like after Labor Day, or is it bad because there's going to be time with nothing going on?
Mm-hmm.
I get the impression there'll be other groups who will come in and play. Now, this is the same thing that the Democrats did in 2018. They reserve their money until after the primary is done, 12-person primary, 14 people, depending on who's actually in by primary day. They weren't going after Walker either. The difference, though, is Walker had, like, universal name ID in 2018. So they felt like, hey, we're going to save all our fire for after the election. People know who he is, whereas Evers, again, a little less hard edges for his numbers. It's going to be expensive race, though. That's my guess. There's going to be lots and lots of money spent. This is a down payment toward that. But keep an eye on who else goes after Evers between now and Labor Day.
And we've talked about the state senator quite a lot this show. Dale Cuenca, you have falling this week because about the possibilities that could replace him.
His fans say he is thoughtful. He's a guy with thinker. He is a serious debater. He's not somebody who throws bombs on the floor. He's also without a home right now, right? Because he's now been moved to a different district. So here's your dilemma. Cuenca actually is living in the new 8th Senate right now because his family tore down his home on his current property to build a new one, and they're renting a home that's in the redrawn district.
Right.
But he told me, I'm not going to be cute and like try and stay there or anything else. This is our home over here. We're going back to my home. If the U.S. Supreme Court does not overturn the lines, I'm okay being done.
Yeah.
Well, here's what happens. It is a little more Democratic district than it was before, which it had moved toward Democrats for the last decade. Biden won it by 8.5 points. It's about more north of 9 right now, typical performance. So Dale might be the one person who could hold that seat, right, because he's the incumbent, he's well-known, et cetera. Republicans can't recruit right now, or they could, but they got to do it quietly because they don't know for sure Dale's on the way out the door.
Right, yeah.
Now, Dale could have another opportunity because Alberta Darling, let's say it stays the same, Alberta Darling's been around for a long time. Perception is she probably won't seek re-election in 2024. If Dale's still in that seat and it's still in place, he could run for that seat, you know, 2 years down the road. So don't write him off forever. Democrats, meanwhile, Robin Vining from the State Assembly is in that seat. Tom Pauzowitz, who ran for Congress against Todd Fitzgerald, is in that new Senate seat. Jessica Katzenmeyer, who ran for the State Assembly 2 years ago, she already announced that she's going to run. So the Democrats are saying this is our best pickup opportunity this fall, and they're all chomping the bit to run for that seat.
Yeah, and Cuenca also serves on the Joint Finance Committee, which we've also seen quite a lot of shakeup, too, of new members coming in and out. So should be an interesting year in what we see these maps ultimately will be. So that will do it for this week's show. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks for joining us.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.